Money here on KPCW. The time is 9:06. It's Monday, November 13th. We're all grinning from ear to ear here at KPCW. I'm Renee Bodley here with my co-host Doug Wells. The reason we're so happy is that news that Ollie Wilder just gave us from the Park City Community Foundation, that with Live PC, Give PC, KPCW tied Mountain Town Music in our fundraising category. And because we tied them, the Park City Community Foundation has decided to give us both first prize, which is $1,250.
Yeah, that was so generous and nice of them. And, you know, I think a lot of donors supported both organizations, myself included. But I'm on the board, and as much as I like Mountain Town Music, my heart is with KPCW. And I was thinking, oh, if I hadn't supported the other organ. And what I love about that solution is now we all feel good, and you don't have to say, gee, do I have to think about that next year? And
you
the
know,
answer is no,
point.
You don't have to.
Great point. Though I told Ollie, I said, we need to make more hay off of this next year and really build up a fun wager with Mountain Town Music and have a friendly competition because we love Mountain Town Music. You know, we're a radio station that plays great music. We broadcast their summer concerts live from Deer Valley. We have a close partnership with them. We want to see them succeed. But on the day of Live PC, Give PC, we're just a little selfish. And instead of giving our time to other nonprofits like we normally do 364 days out of the year, it's the one day of the year that we really ask people to give to us.
And when you think of the theme of that, right, I mean, all the nonprofits are winners. And I think today, this morning, we all feel that way. So thank you to Park City Community Foundation for making that decision. It was very generous. You didn't have to do that, and we certainly appreciate it.
They had more than 4,000 individual donors on Friday just online, and that's how they measure that success. That's really amazing. This community is so generous, and they really support their nonprofits. So thank you to all of our listeners out there, and thank you especially if you donated to KPCW. We couldn't do it without you guys. So here's one of the things we do. Thanks to your support, we put on great public affairs shows every Monday through Friday from 9 to 10 a.m. Monday, we do Mountain Money. That's what you're listening to right now. We've got a great program ahead for you. We're going to talk about profitable podcasting, how you can use podcasting to grow your business, increase revenue. It's more than just pushing out great content. It's all about brand marketing as well. We're going to have Stephen Wozner, the author of Profitable Podcasting, Grow Your Business, Expand Your Platform, and Build a Nation of True Fans. He's going to join us on the phone.
Yeah, podcasting has been around a long time, but it's really seeing a resurgence in its importance. I think that's going to be a great conversation. Our second guest is going to be Craig Elliott and Steve Bremer. They're with Elliott Work Group. We're going to talk to them about their new location. More importantly, we're going to talk to them about their business as architects. And one of their catchphrases is they strive to create real places. And I think we've all experienced that. If you look at the old Main Street Mall here on Main Street, the Elliott Work Group designed that. I thought they did a great job. So we're going to talk about projects like that and what makes for great design. And then our final guest is going to be Mark Siravaca. And he is with Shred Eyewear, and Ted Ligety is involved in Shred Eyewear. I believe he is actually the designer of the eyewear, and we're going to talk to Mark about Shred Eyewear and Ted Ligety's involvement, so it'll be a great morning. You're going to want to tune in. This is Mountain Money on KPCW. We'll be back in a moment.
This is Dr. Phil Davidson of Davidson Orthopedics, proud KPCW sponsor of The Mountain Life. Are you reluctant or worried about having a total knee or shoulder replacement? We offer an array of non-surgical and surgical alternatives. More information on our website at davidsonorthopedics.com.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. I'm Renee Bodley here with my co-host Doug Wells. Our first guest this morning, Stephen Wozner, author of Profitable Podcasting, Grow Your Business, Expand Your Platform, and Build a Nation of True Fans. Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning, Renee. Good morning, Doug. And thank you very much for the invitation. And say congrats on the fundraising success. What a major win for your community. So congratulations.
Thank you very much. First, did I pronounce your last name right?
You know what? I'd have been stunned if you would have, because everybody gets it wrong. So don't feel bad about that. It's Wessner. It's a good German name, silent O.
Wessner. Stephen Wessner. Thank you for that. Okay, first question. You talk about how businesses have some blogs, but podcasting is much different than a business blog. Can you clarify the difference for our listeners, please?
Well, so there's several different ways that the two are different. And first is, sure, the output is similar, right, as far as, you know, content and information and so forth. We believe that a podcast gives a business owner the ability to take that piece of content, that episode, we call that cornerstone content, and then be able to cut that up into a bunch of different smaller pieces of content. So it might be several blog posts, it might be a Facebook post, it might be a LinkedIn post. And so that one piece of content, that cornerstone content, that episode, gives that business owner the ability then to create maybe 30, 40, 50 different pieces of content. Plus, because the audience, you know, heard the business owner's voice, you know, just being able to hear the human voice establishes a connection, that an emotional connection that's even deeper than through the written word. And so being able to hear that author's or that business owner's voice over time, just like you with your listeners, that is a completely different context at the human level. And so that's one of the reasons why podcasting is so effective.
You know, Stephen, I've been a fan of podcasts for a long, long time. There used to be this saying, what's on your iPod? And that would be for music. When I ask people what's on their iPhone, I want to see what podcasts they listen to because they're so powerful. I've got a little bit of drive time. I live in Park City, but I work in Salt Lake City, and I use that time primarily to listen to podcasts. And so my company does exactly what you say. If you went to our website, you'd see at any given time a dozen podcasts that we think are helpful for people. And we like them because it allows us to tell our story in a way that is very difficult to do with other media. As I was reading your book, your aha moment was a beautiful spring day in May of 2015 that started your journey of podcasting. You were looking out the window watching your daughter play. What was it about that day that was your aha moment towards this?
Well, really, it was frustration. First of all, thanks for getting a copy of the book. That's very kind of you. But it was really frustration, and frustration in that our core business, Predictive ROI, really needed a better lead and sales gen, better pipeline. And it's ironic because we're in that business for clients, but we weren't winning for ourselves. And so it was, as I described in the book, I, you know, pounded my dining room table and said, darn it, we need to change something. And I had owned OnwardNation.com for, you know, about 12 months, but, you know, our team really hadn't crafted a strategy around it. So the grand strategy when we decided to launch our show on May 15th, 2015, and then later launched it 30 days later, June 15th, was that we're going to interview a new business owner, you know, every single day, and it was just going to be awesome. And, you know, I mean, that was the extent of the strategy. And then what we found is that by interviewing people who we really wanted to learn from, that in and of itself gave us context of relationship. And then gave us also business development opportunities to the point where at the back half of 2015, we were able to sell over $250,000 of podcast-related services to our guests. And that aha moment really has fueled the business development strategy behind Predictive ROI to this day, because podcasting is so powerful when there's the right monetization strategy tied to it.
You say there's a learning curve when it comes to tackling the technical end of podcasting. How steep is that learning curve?
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, that's a great point, Renee. I think there is a learning curve, but I don't think it's that steep from a technical perspective. I mean, you know, we help our clients get past that pretty quickly, but, you know, any business owner can master that if he or she chooses to do so. I think the bigger learning curve is really overcoming the fear of, and most business owners won't articulate it necessarily as fear. They'll talk about their schedule, how will they make money, but really they're being apprehensive because sometimes the imposter syndrome sneaks in and keeps us from doing it. So really the bigger learning curve is, in my opinion, the content strategy, how that's going to tie in with their core business, and then how the podcast will actually generate revenue for their core business. Being able to figure those things out makes the tech easy to master.
You know, it is amazing how many doors having a podcast opens, both for your business as well as your hobbies. I have a friend that's an attorney. His passion is running, and he started a podcast. I'll give him a little plug for it, Man Bun Running, so like the little bun of hair at the back. But that's his passion, and he started a podcast about a year ago, same thing, imposter syndrome, wasn't sure he could do it. But the reason he did it was he thought it might open the door to allow him to interview some of the folks that he admires that otherwise would be hard for him to have a conversation with. And much to his surprise, he is interviewing on a regular basis Olympic gold medal runners, winners of marathons from all over the world. It's really opened up a lot of doors. Although his challenge is he's got fewer than 1,000 listeners. Now, these gold medalists and these marathon winners don't ask that question, so they don't know when they agree. But what would your advice for somebody like him be as far as building his audience? I know you have a couple chapters in your book on this. How do you build your audience once you have the content?
Yeah, well, great example, Doug. So thank you for sharing that. And the reality is, you know what, there are riches in niches, as our guest Susan Friedman shared with our audience. So, right? So, one of our clients advises Excel in Topeka, Kansas. They built an $8 billion a year business off a 1,000-person prospect list. So numbers do matter, but at the same time, numbers don't matter. And so my suggestion for somebody who does want to build their audience would be, you know, one of the best ways to do that and how we got into 116 countries for Onward Nation is by, you know, really getting active in social media and specifically touting and sharing the wisdom that our guests had shared within each and every episode. And we do that about 15 times for every episode in an ongoing rotation. And we're sharing their wisdom, not mine or what I shared during the episode, because every episode is all about the guest. And so we share, you know, the guest wisdom on Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter. They retweet that because they want to share that with their community, and then our community grows. That is the absolute number one best way to grow a community, is by turning your guests into brand evangelists for your show.
What other social media do you use other than the normal Facebook, Twitter, Instagram? Do you go deep and get into Snapchat and other social media sites?
We don't for right now. I mean, Renee, that's a great question. We don't for right now just because, you know, our business, where we're focusing on, you know, business owners tend to be, you know, running companies of $1 million to $20 million a year, and not that they're not on Snap or not that they're not on Insta. It's just that what we have found is that the greatest concentration for that type of business owner tends to be LinkedIn, followed by Facebook and Twitter. Now, will our social media strategy change over time as demographics change? I'm sure it will. But for our core audience, those three platforms, we've chosen to go deep into those three.
So would you call this type of podcasting journalism, or would you call it advertorials?
You know, that's an excellent question, too, and I think it is journalism, and because I think, you know, and the two of you, my guests, would agree with this, too. You know, when we tune into a podcast episode and there's a lot of selling going on, that feels kind of yucky, right? And instead, you know, our listeners want to get great content. They want to be able to leave with several nuggets that they can take and apply, much like your listeners when they listen to your show every Monday. And so we try to really focus on that. And I think that we get, you know, we're able to get Shark Tank investors and New York Times bestselling authors and leaders of large companies onto our show because I'm no longer, you know, an agency owner looking for a new account. I'm a journalist, and I represent an audience and an audience that would be appealing to them. So absolutely, I think that it is because it's journalism, not advertorial.
You know, you have to be careful. I think people that come to podcasting from journalism look at it very differently than business people that come from podcasting. I don't know if you're familiar with Alex Bloomberg. He was the producer of This American Life for many years. He went out and he started a podcast. He saw the growth in podcasting and said, this is going to be an interesting business model. So he started Gimlet Media, and he got some big-name investors, including people like Chris Sacca, who was one of the initial investors in Twitter. He was a big shot at Google and left and did that. He came from a journalism background, and he's got a really interesting episode on one of his podcasts talking about the journalism ethics. And I share it with my friends that don't understand the journalism ethics. They did a sponsorship with a Microsoft product, and one of his team members said, I use the product and I love it. And Alex and his team had a 45-minute conversation, which they taped. And I'm sharing this because I think our audience doesn't fully understand this journalism standard. And they had a big debate. Even though it was clear it was a sponsorship, they felt tainted by saying, I used a product and I like it. That's very different than reading the copy from somebody. And so there is this tension between journalism and the fact that it's a business and you do need sponsors. Podcast people struggle with that. And candidly to our audience, we at KPCW struggle with that as well. We have to be very careful. And one of the things I'm proud of the radio station on is we always err on the side of journalistic integrity. And there's something about professional journalists that have spent 4 years of their life on a college campus debating this and talking about it that's very valuable to bring into the organization. So for business people, I would advise you to have somebody, a journalistic friend, kind of like on an advisory board to help you with that. So a little bit of a side tangent, but Renee, I think it's a great question about journalistic integrity. We do have to be careful because the audience thinks of this as news. They think of it as reporting, and it's important to wear that journalistic banner properly and cover it well. I want to go back to Renee's question about the technology and how to get started with this. I want to share with the audience the technology. It literally, you can do this over your iPhone. I mean, I wouldn't suggest that, but you honestly can with a good microphone. But let's talk about for business owners that are like, yeah, you know, I could run a podcast. What are the steps? So we have the technology that we have to get going. It's booking guests. It's learning what I call radio speak, which you call in your chapter 10 of your book, audio intros, outros, and design. But let's talk about what it takes to start doing a podcast.
Sure, happy to. So would you mean like about the specific hardware or software that somebody might need?
Let's assume they've got the hardware and the software. There's lots of stuff online with that. It's more of the logistics. For instance, I call radio speak what we did at the top of the hour, the intro, the tease for the show. Then there's the close. We have to hit the mark so that NPR News is next. But just take them behind the scenes as to, from a personality standpoint, from a voice standpoint, what makes a good podcast host?
Yeah, I think what makes a good podcast host is somebody who, you know, is not afraid to really let the audience in, and really is truly them, and not trying to be somebody else or not trying to be somebody who they're not. And in our world, that's the business owner, you know, communicating with his or her audience in a very truthful, certainly or authentic way. And so for us, it really starts with the content strategy. What is it that business owner wants to be able to learn from the guests that he or she interviews? And then, you know, what is the avatar of the desired listener? And really understanding the type of audience that they want to build and nurture and love over time. And then specifically, how do both of those tie into that business owner's core business? How will the podcast become business development for them? Whether that is through selling sponsorships, whether that is through having ideal prospects as guests on the show that will open themselves up to, you know, later business development opportunities, or maybe even selling something to their audience over time if it's appropriate to do so. So before, you know, we get into tech and so forth with, you know, our clients or as we recommend with readers, you know, is really figuring out the core piece of strategy so that they're not, you know, 150, 200 episodes in, and then they look at that and say, gosh, I've invested all this time and effort, but I'm not driving any revenue into my core business. My audience is still small and so forth. So we like to try and solve those problems way up front.
In case you're just joining us, the time is 9:25. We're talking to Stephen Wessner. He's the author of Profitable Podcasting. And it's interesting the difference between podcasting and blogs and how podcasting can really grow revenue. You have a chapter in your book called Your Avatar, Dream 50, and My $2 Million Mistake. What was that?
Well, so Darren Hardy, former publisher of Success Magazine, was on our board of advisors here at Predictive ROI for 12 months. And Darren and I, along with several other you know, well-known speakers like Gary Vaynerchuk from VaynerMedia in New York City and Avinash Kaushik from Google and several others. I had decided that we were going to schedule an event, a live event called Predictive ROI Live in January 2015 at the Ritz-Carlton in Orlando. And the operating budget and the revenue upside for that event was about $2 million. And during the planning process, you know, Darren continued to advise me that I needed to get this figured out as far as the avatar and the value proposition, why anybody would want to come to this event. And I continued to not listen to him. And it wasn't that he wasn't consistent in his advice or that I didn't have the available resources. I had everything available to me to be able to answer this question. And for whatever reason, I was fearful and I chose not to answer it, thinking that somebody, just anybody, was going to pay $8,000 to come to this all-inclusive event to hear Darren and others speak. And I was 100% wrong. I couldn't have been more wrong. And that mistake, you know, cost us $2 million in revenue. But more importantly, you know, sure, we missed out on the upside of revenue, but it cost our business $200,000 in cash that I had to pay back to, you know, the Ritz-Carlton and other partners, which was obviously very expensive. So not getting the strategy right, that's why I spend so much time, you know, being consistent in that recommendation. Not getting the strategy right, not getting the avatar right, can be extremely expensive for a business owner.
Well, let's use an example, because I think this strategy, getting the strategy right, is important. And one that comes top of mind, and it's selfish, is KPCW. We're a community radio station. Obviously, we have a lot of content. Our shows are available via podcasts or available online. What are some strategy things, using us as an example, you would tell us we should think about?
Well, okay, so in my guess is somebody on your team is probably doing this already, but so you might want to take some of your best of episodes, some of your guests that were, you know, really brought something special, and maybe guests that could lead to downstream partnership or sponsorship, but you take the guests that were extremely helpful, and maybe it was the top five or the top 10, and you create a series of ebooks, and then you share that with your community with opt-ins so that you can collect email addresses and build your community. That would be one way to do it. Another way to do that would be to take, you know, each of your, you know, Monday episodes and be able to carve those up into social media posts. And then your guests would, you know, retweet those or share those, and so then your audience grows. Taking the episode recording and producing a long-form transcript from that, giving it to a writer so it doesn't feel like a transcript, but it really reads more like an article. And then there's thought leadership in that article. And it's all around, you know, money, the mountains, and so forth. And so then any small business owner looking for, you know, advice and finance and, you know, access to capital, you know, turns to you guys as the first place, because you're the known thought leaders for that. So then that article becomes a long-form blog post. It can go out to LinkedIn as a long-form article, so your LinkedIn community grows. And then maybe you do this already, and forgive my ignorance, but maybe start recording, you know, video within the studio. And so now you have both video and audio off that same content and put that out to YouTube. So just off the top of my head, those are maybe five or six ways to get leverage out of one recording.
Well, we're writing notes feverishly, so thank you for that. I also want to talk about, I think a lot of our audience doesn't know, how do you get distribution? And one of the neat things about podcasts is the distribution's already figured out for you. And as far as I know, it's free. Talk to our audience about iTunes and why that's important.
Sure, great question, because distribution really, really matters, as you might think. And so, you know, there are several different hosting companies. We use Libsyn, which is Libsyn. They tend to be the leader in hosting the audio, the MP3 files for each of the recordings. There are certainly others, but Libsyn tends to be the biggest and the best. And so then Libsyn is essentially kind of the hub, if you will, and sending it out to all the different spokes, being like, you know, iTunes and Stitcher and Google Play and iHeartRadio, Spotify. All of those distribution points get their feeds from companies like Libsyn. And now there's additional distribution through, of course, you know, smartphones and computers, but now there's additional distribution with, like, you know, Alexa in the home. And so then, you know, podcasts are now getting another 10 to maybe 15% boost because audio at home is becoming a bigger play. So if you're a podcaster, you want to take a look at those types of distribution opportunities as well. That's different than like Libsyn because you have to go to the individual app developers for, you know, Alexa and others. But I think that's going to be the next uptick.
How do you get, let's say your company is Company Widget, and Company Widget decides to start a podcast. How do I get Alexa to play Company Widget's podcast?
Yeah, and it's a bit of a hassle, you know, just in full transparency. And the reason being is because, you know, what we haven't seen yet at scale, well, one, the adoption rate of that, you know, platform is still very, very new, audio at home. It's getting better, but it's still very, very new. And it's a little bit of the wild, wild west as far as the developers of apps, you know, within the Alexa world, they call those skills, you know, the developer of those skills. And each one of those is its own piece of, like, software and their own directory. So you need to reach out to the developers of each of those skills and say, and there are multiple skills for podcasts, and say, hey, I would really like to be listed in your directory. Is that, could you please add Onward Nation or show whatever into your directory so that it's available? Then after some time, they'll say, yep, you're now available on such and such, and now you can listen through Alexa. But it is absolutely a process. It is not a central clearinghouse like Libsyn is with iTunes.
Yeah, no, it's not quite there, although I suspect in 6 months if I said, and I'm going to set off some people's Alexas that are listening at home, Alexa, play Mound Money podcast. I think 6 months, 12 months from now, it literally will be that simple.
I hope so.
So let's wrap up and talk about sponsorships. How do you go for folks that are interested in having commercial sponsorship? If you're a local business and you want to do a podcast, but you want to have some support, financial support, to pay for the technology, to pay for the equipment, to pay for the time, how do you go about finding sponsors that make sense? And how do you think about what to charge them?
The first piece of that is I think they ought to go back to some of the guidance that you gave, Doug, about how to make it really above board and not feel yucky to the listeners, right? So that it is very, very clear that the host has received a sponsorship or a financial sponsorship from XYZ company. So all of that is very above board. So I think the recommendations you gave earlier were really spot on to treat that professionally. And then as far as how you find a sponsor, you essentially narrow the field by thinking about what companies might want to sell through to my audience. And so if your audience are small business owners, as ours is, you know, like the Avanti Entrepreneur podcast, which is one of our clients hosted by Dave Mamano, you know, he was building an audience of small business, you know, owners across the country. And then he thought, the payroll processing company Paychex would be probably interested in being able to sell through to and market to my audience. I'm going to reach out to them, which he did, and said, hey, I have this opportunity. He followed chapter 16 that is in my book, followed that recipe, gave them a proposal. They wrote him a check for $30,000 to be an annual sponsor of his show. So does the pursuit of sponsorships, does it always go that smoothly? No. But chapter 16 in my book breaks down the exact recipe to follow and everything that should be included in a proposal to make sure that you're well-positioned. And then what we're seeing is anywhere between $10,000 to $100,000 a year for annual sponsorships, depending upon your audience size and how else you're going to get that sponsor leveraged in your community.
All right. Well, I think that caught a lot of people's attention towards the end. It's a great note for us to wrap up with. Our guest this morning has been Stephen Westner. He is the author of Profitable Podcasting, Grow Your Business, Expand Your Platform, and Build a Nation of True Fans. Stephen, we enjoyed our conversation with you this morning.
I enjoyed it immensely as well. Thank you, Renee and Doug. Very, very kind of you. I appreciate the time.
You're listening to Mound Money on KPCW, and we'll be back in a moment with Craig Elliott and Stephen Bremer of Elliott Work Group.
Deer Valley Resort is a proud KPCW supporter. Locals only and season passes for the 2017-2018 ski season are available at deerlocals.com or at the Snowpark Ticket Office daily from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Deer Valley's information number is 649-1000.
Hi, I'm Matt Kelly, co-founder of Cat Tongue Grips, proud sponsor of The Local View with Randy Barton. Cat Tongue Grips is a Park City startup that solves the problems of slippery phones, laptops, iPads, and tablets. Apply directly on your mobile device or your case. Details at cattonguegrips.com.
Being a member of the Park City Chamber Bureau is a great investment for your business and provides a wide array of benefits. We promote your business, provide networking and educational opportunities, and even have benefit programs for you and your employees. For more information, visit us online at visitparkcity.com or call us at 649-6100. The Park City Chamber Bureau is a nonprofit organization and a proud supporter of KPCW.
Welcome back to Mound Money on KPCW. Interesting conversation with Stephen Westner, the author of Profitable Podcasting. We're going to switch gears now. In studio with us are Craig Elliott and Steve Bremer of Elliott Work Group. Good morning, gentlemen.
Morning.
Good morning.
So I understand the topic du jour is your new space. I want to get to that first, and then I want to move on to talking about what is, you know, give us examples of good design, good architectural work. So first off, where are your new offices? I know your old offices were on Main Street. Have you wandered far from there?
Yeah, after 15 years in Park City on Main Street, in two different places on Main Street, we've moved to New Park, and we're at 1441 Ute Boulevard, which is the red building for the Cottonwood Partners 1.
Why did you decide to move?
Well, there's a couple of reasons. The first reason was we didn't fit where we were. We have a little over 20 people in our office now, and the space, our design studio space that we now have is about 2.5 times of what we had before. Mm-hmm. And we were literally on top of each other.
I guess it would be hard as an architect if you had a client show up in your workspace. They're hiring you to design their workspace and your workspace doesn't fit your needs. That's not really a good billboard for you.
Yeah, you know, it was good to have a lot of people and have them working close together. But at some point in time, you start losing your productivity. You know, the other thing is that my staff is, it's really centrally located. I have people that live in Summit Park. I have people that live in Heber, people that live in Jeremy Ranch and Pine Brook, and then in Park City and throughout this whole area. And so it's become a really great location for all of my staff because it's really central to where they live.
Yeah, I think it's become a trade-off, unfortunately, that a lot of businesses on Main Street are having to make. Right. I mean, the reality of Main Street, I've been at your old office. You were on several different floors. So you're walking up and downstairs all day long, which is easy for me in my 50s. But, you know, when I get closer to my 70s, that's going to be harder and harder to do. So New Park is a little more convenient. Right. Saves you the drive into town. What are some of the trade offs? What are you going to miss about being on Main Street?
Well, I'll let Steve talk to this, too. But, you know, after 15 years of coming to Main Street, there's a lot of vibrancy. There's a lot of things going on that we're involved in the historic district. And being so close to that really helps you understand how things work in town. So if you're working on projects in the historic district and you live and work there, it really is helpful. And there's just a lot of people. I mean, I still go to the post office every day because we have a personal post office box. But, you know, I there's many times I don't get out of the post office for an hour. And so I hope I don't miss that, but I have found that I've run into a number of different people now in New Park.
And Steve, you wanted to comment on that?
Yeah, I mean, I feel the same way. It's just that proximity or the old town character, you know, that we're used to of walk out for lunch every day and be able to meet and talk to everyone in town and interact with everyone. That's one of the things I think I missed the most was that daily interaction. But now that we're out at the Junction, you know, we just make a special trip. You know, come into Old Town and come visit either the city or the restaurants and make our way around town.
And if you stay for less than 2 hours, you can park for free
starting
December 15th.
Well, full disclosure, the Elliott Work Group is helping KPCW design an expansion of our space that we're currently in. And Craig, you and I met and talked about workflow and talked about the design of the space and what it would look like and whether it suited our needs. I found that exercise to be incredibly helpful. Walk our listeners through what questions they should be asking themselves about how to design their own workspace.
Oh, that's interesting. I think the first thing to understand if you have more than one person is how do you interact with the other people that you're working with? And then what kind of spaces do those people need? And once you begin to understand the interaction and the quality of space, the type of space that someone needs, then you can start to identify how big they are, what shape they are, what the relationships to the spaces are. And you can find a way that creates something that functions. I truly believe that design is a problem-solving process, and that if you can solve the problem and create something that works for you, you're going to end up with something that is valuable for a long time.
And how do you create energy for the workspace? So people get there and they just have this feel, this is where I want to be. I want to spend time here. And I'm going to tee up an example for you. I don't know if you've ever been to Amazon headquarters.
I haven't.
But for many, many years, you know, you think of Amazon. I mean, they were the juggernaut. They're even a bigger juggernaut. But back then, they were really just books. But if you went to their headquarters, most of it was open space. In most people's desk were doors that were propped up on construction type facility, but it had a neat energy and it spoke of Amazon's culture, right? We work hard, but we're the low cost leader, and so we're frugal. From a design standpoint, how do you do that?
We can talk a little bit about our office. I mean, and Steve and I over the years actually built most of the desks previously. We have plywood. And all of our workers are in the same space. So everybody in our office, including me, is in the same design studio. So that supports that sort of interaction and that creativity. And then what you're seeing as a trend in office space design is creating separate spaces to go have private conversations and meetings. And so we have a conference room, a library, two plan rooms. And so that instead of putting people in private offices and isolating them, we've engaged everybody into the same space. And then you can talk a little bit about that too.
Well, yeah, I was just going to say it's that old mentality of the doors on sawhorses. You know, when Craig says plywood, it's a little nicer than that. You know, it's finished material. But then we, you know, engineered into it some steel pipe to support it, to turn it into a tabletop or a workstation. But it really creates that open environment, you know, that you just don't get with a cubicle environment where you're kind of closed off from everybody, or even worse, you know, everyone gets their own private office, you don't interact. The studio environment really sets itself up to that more interaction, everybody can communicate across.
And as architects and designers, you must love all of this new technology that is sleek and streamlined, and we don't have those big boxy computers anymore.
Go ahead.
Yeah, it certainly gives you more space. It's funny, though. I mean, you start to get 27-inch monitors, and all of a sudden you're peeking over the top of them now because you do get more screen space, but you definitely get more workspace. But the streamlining is definitely a sleeker look and certainly what people are looking for.
And let's talk about a project just about everybody here in Park City is familiar with. And for those of us that have been here five or more years, which many of us have been, we have the before and after, which was the mall on Main Street. I remember when I first moved here, the very first time I walked down Main Street, I hate to say it, but I was like, this is an atrocity, the before. I mean, it just didn't belong. These big cinder blocks, it was very sterile.
Dark inside.
I love the new look. And I read a quote when it was first passed by City Hall, and Craig, I think the quote was yours, is you wanted Main Street, you wanted Park City to be the attraction, not the mall itself, not the building itself. And I think he captured that. Okay. Talk to us about that process. How do you come up with something that works?
Well, thanks. I said many times when we were working on that project that Main Street's the mall. You don't need a separate mall on Main Street. And so if that's the case, then you need to engage the street with your retail instead of turning your back on it. And it historically, it turned its back on it. And so the first thing we did was try to find a way where we could create retail space that opened onto the street on the sidewalk and then extended back underneath the rest of the building structure. And from a design perspective, everything came into place after that. That was the problem-solving part of it. And in addition to the underground parking that we put and expanded the tunnel that was underground so that they had parking underneath for the units above, those two things were probably the problem-solving part of it. The design and the aesthetic component came along over time, and you know, it's amazing. Design processes oftentimes happen when you don't expect it. And the first sketches of that came when my wife and I were on vacation in Carmel. I came back and said, hey, I think we got something. And we moved forward. And, you know, that's what we ended up with.
We should also disclose who your wife is. It's Emily Elliott of KPCW, who is our rock star underwriting development officer here, who does a great job.
Yeah. So that was that's how we kind of get to those solutions. And then really trying to find out, how do you create something, and Steve, we talk about this all the time, is how do you create something that's respectful of the history of where you're working, the vernacular of where you're working, and respectful of the time and place that you're working. So you're trying to merge all of these things together, its history and its current time. And I think only time will tell whether you do that with a building.
A friend of mine who's an architect said his litmus test for a good design is, if you parachuted into a place overnight and it's pitch black, and you wake up the next morning, sun's coming up, you look around and say, I know I'm in Park City, or I could be in anywhere USA. So if you could wave a magic wand to be the grand poobah of Park City designers and developers, and you can expand this out to Summit County if you want, the Park City, Summit County area, what would you say is the biggest challenge and how you would fix it? And then we'll end on a positive note. What has Park City or Summit County done really well?
Oh, wow. Steve, you got any?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, we talk about that a lot. I'm on the design review committee out at the Canyons, so I'll reach out to the county and maybe let Craig key in on Park City. But, you know, oftentimes we have that conversation with developers as they come in saying, you know, how does this building or your project represent Park City? Or how does it tell someone they're in Park City so that they have that memorable experience when they come and they go and they say, man, that's a place I really want to go back to. It's a challenge, and we definitely don't want to be anywhere USA. We already kind of have that. People already recognize that. And what is it that people recognize? And I think it's a lot of the mining character. It's definitely a lot of our historic district. There's many things that make that come together. But when it comes to design side, it's even the night skies ordinance, things like that help keep Park City's unique character, you know, dark at night. It's not Las Vegas. It's not bright and lit up. It's something different. And I think it's a combination of things. It's really a design challenge, but I think it's something we look to when we're architects and given a project. We try to create a place that's sensitive to the surrounding neighborhoods and not feeling out of character and not being so modern that it looks out of place.
And I think when you're dealing with a historic district, I've said this before, is that I think what's important to do is there's two ways to approach putting a new building into it. There's one thing about renovating, and I think what they've done really well is preserve the historic buildings in town. Park City's done that extremely well. When you're inserting a new building or in addition to a historic building, I think the critical part is taking an approach. And one of those approaches is you use a vernacular form, a historic form that's there, and then treat it with a new material. So you can look at it and say, hey, that's appropriate, but it's still of today. The other way is to do something that's more of a modern or contemporary form and use vernacular materials on it. So there's sort of two different approaches that I see in inserting new structures, new buildings into a historic environment. And I think, the way they've preserved the historic buildings in town, as citizens, I think has been really, really good. And I think there's just a number of different ways to get there. Not everybody understands those because mimicry doesn't always provide the best new building in a historic district.
Yeah, I think the Park City Library is probably a good example of blending new with retaining the history of that building as well. And frankly, I think the next frontier for Park City is our front street right here, Sweet Alley, to see what the city ends up doing there. I think we have a chance to really get that right, and I know some smart people are thinking about it. Unfortunately, we need to wrap up. Our guests this morning have been Craig Elliott and Steve Bremer of Elliott Work Group. Congratulations on the new site, and thanks for your role in keeping Park City unique and historic.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
You're listening to Mountain Money on KPCW. We'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned.
This is Ryan Hoffman, manager at Mountain West Bank, sponsor of KPCW. We're a community bank with a great understanding of our local needs. Mountain West Bank has something unheard of nowadays, but I can't say it on the radio. We're next to the movies near Kearns Boulevard at 649-3369. Division of Glacier Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. Cookies on Fridays.
Mountain Money on KPCW is sponsored in part by Columbus Pacific Properties, presenting Viridian, 21 new residences along the 11th fairway of the Canyons Golf Course with year-round amenities and gondola access. Summers on the fairway, winters on the slopes. More information at ViridianParkCity.com.
Matt here from San Francisco Design, supporting our local radio station, KPCW. Since 1990, San Francisco Design offers interior design and a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings with store locations in Salt Lake City and Park City on Bonanza Drive. On the web at sanfrandesign.com. San Francisco Design. Love your home.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. Fun conversation this morning, first with Profitable Podcasting, then talking with Craig Elliott and Steve Bremer. In studio with us now is Mark Siravatka. He is with a company that has a cool name, Shred Eyewear, which is sunglasses. Mark, welcome to Mountain Money.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you guys are doing sunglasses. It's a very competitive space, but you guys have a secret weapon. You have an ambassador and a designer that's a very famous skier. Tell us about him.
Yeah, Ted Ligety is the boss of the company.
In this town, you just need to say Ted and everybody knows who you're talking about.
Yeah. Ted actually started Shred Optics with Carlos Salmini, who's a co-founder. And it actually started out of Ted's garage here in town. And we started with goggles and then moved into helmets, ski goggles, ski helmets. And the sunglasses have always been around, but this new endeavor that we're making is, going through Kickstarter campaign to really introduce a new way to see better.
Yeah. So eyewear is really a competitive space. The goggles are very competitive. What do you think it was about the space that attracted Ted?
I think what attracted us about it is that a lot of the industry is saturated by these big companies that don't really get the point of what athletes and true avid skiers and athletes really need. And Ted, is probably the best tester out there and using the product every day. And we all are skiers. I'm a skier and snowboarders, and we really think that we bring a very new and unique way to look at product, offering quality product, and
So what's missing in the existing goggle selection before Shred came on board?
One thing was, if we're talking about goggles, it's field of view. That's the biggest thing. A lot of these companies are talking about a lot of, they try to create other issues, but in the end, we notice a lot of these, you see them on the ski hill all the time, like big looking goggles that in the end, if you look at them from the inside, you have a tunnel vision. And that really affects safety and everything. And but what we are bringing now this year that's really special is our new boosting lenses that offer you contrast that you really need with, I think, from a young ski racer to an older skier or rider. On a flat light day, it can be really tough to be able to see the terrain in front of you. And even when you're mountain biking and anytime you're outside, these new boosting lenses allow you to really see the definition on the ground and what's in front of you.
So, they're here. Are these examples
that
you brought?
These are the ones right here. Yeah, yeah. And
they are lightweight.
Super lightweight. That's another thing that we did was, if you can see how we cut the frame on the inside, these are Italian-made frames. And lenses made in Japan and putting together. And yeah.
Oh, these feel good. So we will take a picture of these and we'll post them along
with the show. They do feel good. They feel different.
They feel really light, especially on the nose bridge. It feels really comfortable. Why did you decide to go with Kickstarter?
So we have been doing goggles and helmets for a long time. And like you guys were saying, is that the sunglass market especially is extremely tough to do well in, and the Kickstarter is a new and cool way to be able to break into the market and offer a quality product at a reasonable cost to our consumers and our fans, because we're just cutting out the middleman. We're just going straight to the people that really care about the product and that need something good.
And where do you make these?
So these are made in Italy and in Japan. So the lenses in Japan, frames in Italy.
And then you ship them all over here and ship them out from here?
Yeah, all over the world, yeah.
And then as far as getting the word out, so Kickstarter is great, but people have to find you there. How do you get people to your website and know about these campaigns?
Well, for locals, you can stop by right at our office here at 1260B Iron Horse, right next to Fairweather Foods and Windy Ridge. And we're right there. We're open 9 to 5 every day. And on our website, that's open 24/7, and that's at shredoptics.com.
And tell us a little bit about your background. How did you get started in this, Mark?
Oh, well, with Shred, it's a pretty funny story. I met Carlo, the co-founder, in Chile, skiing up on the mountain, and we got to know each other, and we really hit it off. And I knew Ted. He was a lot better ski racer than I was, but I knew him from the ski racing circuit, and we always just got along very well, and I sort of just grew into the company. You know, it's been 11 years now, so... Yeah.
So Ted's a very intense guy, right? He's very committed to his sport. What's he like as a business leader?
He's actually a great boss. He obviously has a lot to focus on with his ski racing career. But he does, whenever he's in town, show up and talk to us, the employees, you know, and connects with us always on time, always responding to emails. And I mean, Ted really brings the vision to the company. He has the hardest job of all. He wins medals, which ultimately really does help us the most.
So let's talk real quick. The Kickstarter campaign goes for how long?
It goes for 26 more days, I believe, the last time I looked. And we actually have already surpassed our goal 2 times. And we're going to keep on pushing. And we still have plenty of offers left on there. And we're really excited about it. I mean, the whole office is buzzing. Everybody's pushing really hard to make this happen. So,
and to get in the Kickstarter campaign, how much do you need to contribute?
Oh, you can contribute as little as $1, and you can get a free autographed postcard from Ted or any of our other athletes. We are an athlete-born company, so we really try to support them.
And what price do the goggles and the sunglasses start at?
So the sunglasses go from $140 to $180, depending on their polarization or not. And our goggles vary from, $90 up to $200. Yeah.
Got it. Okay. Yeah. Mark Sirovodka, anything else you want our listeners to know about the eyeglasses?
No, just, check us out, stop by the office and say hello. We'd be happy to show you, the future of eyewear and, protection.
And share your website with us?
Shredoptics.com.
Shredoptics.com. Thank you very much. Mark Sirovodka with Shred Optics. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Whitney Wall from Park City Mountain and proud supporter of KPCW. Park City Mountain hosts winter events throughout the season, including Snowfest, the annual Torchlight Parade, New Year's Eve celebration, Spring Groove, and more. More information about all the events happening at Park City Mountain this winter can be found at parkcitymountain.com.
This is Tom Roney with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties. We are committed to serving Park City and are proud supporters of KPCW. More information at bhhsutah.com or one of our 24 offices throughout Summit and Wasatch counties.
This is Matt Mitten, attorney with Jones Waldo, a Park City law firm. Longtime supporters of KPCW, our firm provides estate planning and other personal legal services to residents of Summit County and beyond. We are online at joneswaldo.com and 435-200-0085.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by AMA Waterways and Park City Air Cruise and Travel, 565-4730, parkcityaircruiseandtravel.com, Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com, Fred Marshall Painting, painting Park City's home since 1974, fredmarshallpainting.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
Welcome back to Mound Money. We want to first thank our great sponsors for the show. We couldn't do something like this without the sponsorship of great underwriters, and they include Mountain West Bank, Vacasa, Park City Chamber Bureau, Jones Waldo, Holbrook and McDonough, Columbus Pacific Properties with Viridian and Apex Residences, San Francisco Design, Park City Mountain, and Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties.
And thank you to our excellent guests this morning. We had author Stephen Wessner. His book is called Profitable Podcasting, Grow Your Business, Expand Your Platform, and Build a Nation of True Fans. Not just fans, but true fans. And then secondly, we had Craig Elliott and Steve Bremer, and they are with the Elliott Work Group, an architectural firm that has been on Old Town's Main Street for many, many years, and they just moved out to a new workspace in the Kimball Junction area. And then finally, we had Mark Sirovodka with Shred Eyewear. It was a lot of fun seeing those new sunglasses. The Shred Optics is a company started by Ted Ligety. Everyone knows Ted in town. And they have some new sunglasses out that you can be part of the ground floor with that, with a Kickstarter campaign that they just started. So it's been a great day here on Mountain Money. And thank you again to everyone who donated to KPCW for Live PC, Give PC. We had a great day, Doug, $44,000. Thanks to all of our listeners out there. We couldn't have done it without you. NPR News is right now.